The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Frank Urban from Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading from Smithsonian, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institution. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. Last week, we ran out of time when we were reading American Rhapsody, 70 classical musicians, 200 acres of windblown prairie, and the bracing spirit of the heartland, a Kansas symphony in six movements by Jeff Greger. And we'll pick up where we left off. We've put conservation easements on all the acres we can that we actually own and control, which isn't enough, but it's some. But yeah, the generational transfer in this generation and the next generation after that coming up is going to drastically change this landscape, because right now, land is really starting to turn over in this area. A lot of older absentee landowners are selling to liquidate funds, and it's going to change things. There's a depth of knowledge that's already disappearing. Christy Davis is executive director of the Symphony in the Flint Hills nonprofit. She worked at the Kansas Historical Society and runs a preservation business, too, and owns what may be the most charming laundromat in America, just across the street. Over a steak salad at the Grand Central Hotel in Cottonwood Falls, she gets right to the point. To me, the Flint Hills is a really big cultural landscape. What I do every day is help preserve this massive cultural landscape that's probably the most important cultural resource in the state, maybe in the country. Our event celebrates this place, but never forget that it's important to protect the place that we're celebrating. With the idea that it's taken 20,000 years to become this place, and we can screw it up in 30. That said, how do they get the Kansas City Symphony Orchestra and a giant stage and 6,000 or 7,000 people from the middle of somewhere to the middle of nowhere? The stage comes on trailer, says site coordinator Bill Hartnett. All the audio and lighting equipment comes in 5 26-foot box trucks. So all in all, the heavy equipment, it's about 70 to 80 trucks in and then turn around and leave. And 70 to 80 come back to pick it all up and take it away. And 60 to 70 structures. Parking for 3,000 cars. The site changes every year. We started planning for 2019 months ago. Back up the highway in Kansas City, there is a luncheon for the symphony and the Flint Hills board and rehearsal for the KCSO and guest artist Off O'Donovan. After the rehearsal in the Kauffman Center for the Performing Arts, Jason Sieber, associate conductor of the KCSO, who will lead the orchestra the night of the Flint Hills concert, talks about the specific challenges of that venue. The heat and the wind especially make things challenging, just because music is blowing all over the place. Anytime you're in an outdoor environment like that, especially one that is not a permanent structure, it's not like a concert hall where you have all those acoustics built in so we can hear each other well. Evan Hollowen, double bassist, agrees. It's harder to keep the bass in tune because as it warms up, it expands a little bit, and the bow. So I don't know if this is too technical, but we put rosin on our bow, and it's like at room temperature. It's like powder. And then when it gets a little warmer, it turns into liquid. And it's just like it's harder to grip the string. But there's nothing you can do about it. You just play through it. Susie Yang and Meredith McCook are cellists. One time, Susie recalls, it was very windy, and another cellist's music flew off. So he jumped off the stage with his cello, got the music, got back on stage, and started playing. I always hope for wind, because the stagnant heat is what can really get you. And they always have horses in the distance, Meredith says, with the sun setting while you're playing. So it's always very beautiful, and it's a very one-of-a-kind experience for us and for the audience, I think. It's kind of like when I go out to the Grand Canyon, adds Lawrence Figg, also a cellist. You lose yourself. You're suddenly much smaller than anything you can imagine in the universe. You're one with this huge landscape. I mean, talk about big sky. When I say big sky, that's a big sky. You become so tiny as soon as you get out there. He's played every one of these Flint Hills concerts. So has violinist Alex Shum. Even on the way driving out here, I begin to breathe deeper, and I feel more expansive. The cowboy music, the American music, the view, the horizon. So you sit out there, enjoy the space, soak in the music. I think you just feel rejuvenated. I joined the orchestra in 1978. Almost 40 years I've been here. I grew up in Hong Kong. Buildings, no space. I couldn't believe there's such an area. Limitless. You can see as far as the eyes can see. No trees, no houses. The Flint Hills National Scenic Byway, Kansas Route 177, runs north-south from Council Grove down to Cassoday. It is an astonishment. Don't hurry, you'll find yourself pulling over more than once to take advantage of what the locals call the view shed. And while this land demands to be walked, to be lived on, to be felt under your feet or galloped across, to drive these rolling hills at dawn or at dusk under a sky the color of saffron feels like the kind of proto-road trip that speaks to a mythology as powerful as that of the lonesome cowboy. Cars and landscapes and speed. This isn't the zombie driving we complain about on Midwestern interstates. It's more like finding yourself in the closing scene of your own movie or brushed into a painting by George Callum Bingham. That light. Windows down and the clean rush of air over the car, the cool and the shadows coming off the hills, the bird song in the distance, and the smooth turning of the world beneath you. Feels like a kind of optimism. And in those moments you can find in yourself a reminder of why so many for so long came west. From Europe, from the coast, from the east with its Park Avenue aristocracy and its factories and its smokestacks, its boardrooms and its barren fisheries and exhausted forests, its hedge funds and its courtiers and its pedicures. Somehow, the East has always felt used up, at once corrupt and corrupting. But oh, the West! The West is somehow always new, still fresh, still green. The frontier closed more than 100 years ago, but the West of our imagination remains pristine and unpopulated, the illusion of which is our true inheritance. No matter the reality, the West is always America's second chance. Thus, in the glow of myth and mourning, it's easy to forget that energy extraction is the other big local business. It's powering the car you're riding in. It employs a lot of people hereabouts and pays out a lot on oil and gas leases to farmers and ranchers. The Koch brothers' empire got its start just up the road, in fact, and their Flint Hills Resources Company is headquartered over in Wichita. And a lot of that oil and a lot of that gas sits right under the Flint Hills. So, to paraphrase Ben Franklin, the tall grass prairie is an Eden, if you can keep it. Alexa Dawson is dark-eyed and wears a single mom's expression of tired amusement. We sat and talked at the Hoy's place over in Cedar Point. She lives on the other side of the county with her two daughters, one of whom, 7-year-old Rosemary, has just finished telling us she can drive a skid loader and is a great dancer. Alexa holds down two part-time jobs, bartending at Ad Astra up in Strong City and at Mulready's over in Emporia. She's also the lead singer and songwriter of The Skirts, whose mandolin player is Annie Wilson's daughter, Emily, a popular local acoustic roots band that just released their second album, called Mother. Just about a year ago, she raised objections to a proposed wastewater injection well out near Diamond Creek, not far from the Tall Grass Prairie Preserve. Along with several other women, she was crowdfunding a legal campaign to oppose the high-pressure injection of salt water deep into the limestone, a consequence of which is often human-induced seismic activity, earthquakes. They lost, but the Flint Hills stewards were born. Also, there are enhanced oil recovery wells where they're pushing fresh water, often into the earth down way below the water table, to extract oil and salt water. The water usually doesn't get recycled, but put back down into these holes. So we're polluting and depleting all of this water to get just a little bit of oil out of the ground. We are going to start talking to the rural water districts that are selling the water to pressure them as consumers to get them to stop selling it. Alexa worries about oil company earthquakes and polluted agribusiness runoff and wind farms and pesticides. Alexa is Native American, Potawatomi, and this is her home. For hundreds of years, the Osage and the Wichita, the Pawnee and the Kansa, the people of the Southwest, all made their homes along the streams and rivers here, until forced farther south onto ever-shrinking holdings by settlers from the east. These were their communal hunting grounds, and today are littered everywhere with napped flint arrowheads. By the end of the 19th century, the Kansa were mostly gone from Kansas, relocated to Oklahoma. This place is crowded with old ghosts. I have to take the time to restore my spirit and then go back out and resist again, she says. I need to spend time observing the prairie and observing the animals and plants that are there and undisturbed. Getting to escape and be in that place is very restorative for me. I think it empties my head, restores my soul, fills my heart. Being in that space helps me keep my calm center, always remembering, okay, I'm not supposed to save the world, but I do have to do my little part, and I know why I'm doing it. The prairie is definitely the inspiration for all of it, the reason for activism, for everything. The concert this year, lucky number 13, is down in Butler County on the Rosalia Ranch of the Gotch Cattle Company. The site takes up a couple hundred acres on the vast property. In fact, the ranch is nearly the same size as the Tallgrass Prairie Preserve, 10,000 acres. Lonnie and Carlos are volunteers. This is my 12th year, Lonnie says. My favorite part is when they play the last tunes and they drive the cattle across the prairie. I don't care how many times you've seen it. It just takes your breath away. Do you cry at the singing of Home on the Range? Carlos asks. No, I'm past that. You're a hard man, Lonnie. Yeah. The Flint Hills are amazing, says former Kansas governor and former Secretary of Health and Human Services Kathleen Sebelius. You can see what first Americans saw on the prairie, with native grasses and wildlife. I knew what a treasure this land was in the heartland. Symphony in the Flint Hills began under her tenure as governor. She and then-Senator Nancy Kassenbaum worked to secure the Tallgrass Prairie National Preserve and collaborated with the Nature Conservancy to make sure that the park and surrounding lands were protected. One of the challenges, said Sebelius, was navigating an appropriate balance. We were able to secure with an agreement with utility companies not to purchase wind energy within a certain boundary, defined by already paved roads, and with landowners who agreed to the preservation area and to promote the voluntary boundaries. Senator Nancy Kassenbaum was a champion for making sure that the finances would support the park area from being sold and developed. Maybe it is enough to say of Senator Kassenbaum, now 86, and the causes and conservation she championed, that when she retired from Washington, when she came home, she settled here, in the Flint Hills, in the quiet of the tall grass, not far from Council Grove. Due respect to every man in Kansas, it feels like women made this happen. The day is covered wagons and cowboys, horses and cattle, wind and sun. There's a giant labyrinthine story circle made of straw bales. Over there, just on the brow of that hill, tent talks from national experts on tall grass and water, this year's theme, and waterways and freshwater mussels and the little silver fish found hereabouts. Topeka Shiners. Annie Wilson and her band, the Tallgrass Express, are walking around. There are food tents and beverage tents, and tents for the patrons, and tents for the lecturers, and a tent for kids to try musical instruments. There's a stargazing tent with telescopes the size of Civil War artillery pieces, and long lines of people asking questions like, "Is that Venus? Can I see the International Space Station?" There are tents for cookies and water and folding chairs, first aid and emergencies, and guided prairie walks. They'll all vanish in a day or two. It's Brigadoon by way of Werner Herzog. There's a media tent, too, where the young, avid writers and artists and photographers of the Flint Hills Media Project come and go. They produce a stunning annual journal of the event. There's an art tent, of course, because in addition to beef and grain, the American prairie has produced art and artists in great abundance. Something in that powerful isolation, maybe, the profound solitude of the plains, puts an artist in mind of heaven and earth and our place in things. Gwendolyn Brooks and Langston Hughes and W. Eugene Smith and Gordon Parks and Charlie Parker and William Burroughs are all connected to Kansas. The tall grass prairie and the Flint Hills stand as their own subcategory of Kansas arts. In every medium, from music and poetry to pottery and photography and plein air painting. By acclamation, the greatest work of art ever produced in the Flint Hills is 1991's Prairie Earth by William Least Heatmoon. If you draw two lines from the metropolitan corners of America, he wrote, one from New York City, southwest to San Diego, and another from Miami, northwest to Seattle, the intersection would fall a few miles from my position. A wide, deep exploration of Chase County, it remains a canonical work of 20th century American nonfiction. The Flint Hills Quilt Trail is worth traveling as well. The concert program tonight blends Aaron Copland and John Williams with Peggy Coolidge and Peter Boyer and Bedrich Smetana. The orchestra is in remarkable tune, and the sky is a Maxfield Parrish wash of turquoise and orange. And Orff O'Donovan has a voice like clear water from a silver pitcher. The audience is rapturous. And why not? As Jason Sieber says, we try to program this concert so that it has a nice mix between the standard classical repertoire and some of the off-the-beaten-path pieces by major composers such as Aaron Copland, pieces that don't normally get programmed in the concert hall, but are representative of the landscape. The theme this year was waterways, so we ended up programming that Rolling River, Sketches on Shenandoah. In general, we are thinking of what kind of music is going to be peaceful like the prairie, and expansive, open, wide. In Peter Boyer's reimagined Shenandoah, and the Smetana and the Copland all succeed tonight, wildly so, in part because each is familiar and lyrical without ever seeming shop-worn. Everyone knows the music without knowing it. Smetana, a Czech, was describing in The Modal the flow of the river Vltava through countryside on its way to the city of Prague. Tonight his music is the wind across the green sea. Copland, America's most emphatically American symphonic composer, has managed in every moment of the Red Pony to capture nature in art. Morning on the Ranch is audibly, recognizably, exactly that to every rancher in this audience. The signature showstopper from the time of the founding is the Home on the Range sing-along, closing the night. At that moment, Beethoven, Brahms, Bach have nothing on Dr. Brewster Higley, a Kansas transplant who composed it as a poem for his local newspaper in 1873 or so. Set to music by a neighbor, Daniel Kelly, and many times revised and rearranged since, it was made the Kansas State Song in 1947. It is a thing to see 6,000 Kansans singing and swaying in the twilight, tears welling, throats catching. The only hitch this year are the cattle. A dozen or so cowboys are meant to drive the picturesque little herd across a hill adjacent to the stage, but this year the beef are uncooperative and stubbornly head wrongwise back the other way. Still, the sky is afire, and O'Donovan's voice coos a fevered world as she leads a joyous chorus in melody and solidarity. Turns out the ones likeliest to smile, cry, are the old ranchers themselves, and tears stream down those raw-boned cheeks, unashamed. Folks head up the aisles, wiping their eyes. I thought it was great. The musicians, they're world-class. Them playing out here is a once-in-a-lifetime experience. The landscape is what's so amazing, because it's Kansas, and we think that it's flat, and it's not. Yep, it's not flat at all. The soloist was, oh my gosh, her voice is just magical. I didn't know what to expect, O'Donovan says afterward. I don't think I could have possibly realized how cool it was going to be until I was actually singing Home on the Range as the sun was setting. It was really incredible. I had no idea something like that existed. Just kind of flabbergasted. More than anything, I was struck by the sheer beauty and grandeur of the landscape, and the fact that there's an organization that gets an entire orchestra to the middle of the prairie. And there's just this big community event. I felt like the people in the Tallgrass Prairie just had this love for the place. They want to revitalize and for community that you find in really remote places. Even though it's actually not that remote, we were only a couple of hours from Kansas City. Usually when I've done big orchestral outdoor concerts, I think people are there more to have a picnic or chat with friends. People were really taking in the music in a way that often outdoor audiences don't. I'm not sure why that was. Maybe just the fact that they were within this incredible natural amphitheater. But they were really listening. As a performer, looking out and seeing people responding to the music was as much of a gift as the beauty of the place. And with that, O'Donovan heads back out on the road. There's a long line for the telescopes at the stargazing tent. There's the Western Swing Trio Hot Club of Cowtown in the dance tent. There are cowboy poets in the story circle, and cowboy singers and cowboy listeners, and cowboy hats and cowboy boots, belt buckles as big as the Queen's Tea Service. The stars fan out across the sky, and everywhere you turn, there are slow dancers and handholders, bare-shouldered two-steppers, and sly stolen kissers, wanderers and wagon riders, all beneath a crescent moon. An hour or two later, you'll see Jason Sieber in line at the McDonald's down under El Dorado. Double quarter-pounder value meal. I think we played pretty well, he'll tell you. People head for their cars to wait out the traffic. The road and the world seem far away. That's it. That's the end. It's quieter now. Most folks are gone, and just a few feet from the tents or the stage, the light falls off until the world goes black. You step out into it, somewhere behind you in the dark. Annie Wilson sings on. That concludes American Rhapsody by Jeff McGregor. Kind of makes you want to go to Kansas. I always enjoy, if we have time, wrapping up with some question and answers on the Ask Smithsonian page. You've got questions, we've got experts. I've seen migrating geese flying in V formation, and the sight always makes me wonder how the point bird is chosen. Is it always the same one? Claire Muscus of Lisbon, Connecticut asks. It isn't always the same bird. Migration is an energy-intensive endeavor. When geese fly together, each one cuts air resistance for the ones behind it. Flying point requires more energy. The heart rate of trailing birds is about 15% slower, so the birds take turns doing it, says Autumn Lynn Harrison, a researcher at the National Zoo's Migratory Bird Center. By switching frequently between leading and trailing positions, the birds get where they're going more quickly. For his artwork, Preamble, Mike Wilkins celebrated the nation's bicentennial by stringing together vanity license plates from all 50 states and the District of Columbia to phonetically spell out the preamble to the Constitution. What would he have done if any state would have declined to issue him a plate? Asks Kim Cropper of Bethesda, Maryland. It never came to that, though Wilkins, whose preamble hangs in the Smithsonian American Art Museum, says two states balked. Minnesota worried that the plate he'd requested, UNDE, for the middle syllables of common defense, might be misread as undies, but was easily persuaded. Georgia, which he wanted for FEC space UNE, part of Perfect Union, said no, because he had no car registered in the state. He enlisted the support of the state's biggest newspaper, then aptly named the Atlanta Constitution, and a U.S. senator. He even joked about getting a plate from the then Soviet Republic of Georgia. And one day, he says, the plate showed up in the mail without explanation. How does that garlic smell get into your skin, your sweat, and your breath? Asks Bruce Anderson, Palo Alto, California. Blame your gut. Smashing or chopping a garlic clove initiates a chemical reaction that produces a quartet of volatile organic compounds. All four contribute to garlic breath, says Joe Brunetti, a horticulturalist at the National Museum of American History's Victory Garden. But one of them, I won't pronounce it, A-L-L-Y-L-M-E-T-H-Y-L sulfide, or AMS, is most to blame. Your gut doesn't break it down, so it enters the bloodstream and passes through your lungs and into your skin once you inhale it or sweat it out. But you needn't swear off garlic, Brunetti says. Chemicals in apples, lemons, fresh parsley, spinach, or mint neutralize, that is, not merely mask, garlic breath. And to get the odor off your hands after working with garlic, wash with salt or lemon or a dab of toothpaste, or rub your hands across a stainless steel utensil running under water. Will my refrigerated magnets lose their power of attraction as they age? Yes, asks Leon Hoffman of Chicago. Yes, but so slowly, says Ion Laskew, a research geologist at the National Museum of Natural History, that it will be centuries before you have to worry about your school lunch menus falling to the floor. Man-made magnets' atoms are lined up in the same direction and stay that way unless exposed to extreme heat, a physical blow, or a strong magnetic field in a different direction. That would cause the atoms to vibrate out of alignment, reducing or erasing the magnet's power. I hope you've enjoyed today's reading of Smithsonian. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Frank Urban, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, TriangleReadingService.org. Address any questions to us at 919-832-5138.